Tonight we have the 8th chapter of Daniel, and we're going to find that it also is a very interesting chapter. It too is dealing with prophecy that deals with a part of time that we are very intimately involved with. So we begin in the first verse. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, even unto me Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the first. Now here's another vision that Daniel has. This is in the third year of the reign of Belshazzar, which is 50-60 years now after Daniel has been brought to Babylonia in captivity. And we have here in the 8th chapter now, the writing goes back into the Hebrew language. It has been from the 2nd chapter through the 7th chapter in the Chaldean language. But now this part of the book begins to pertain specifically more to the Hebrew people, to the Hebrew nation. It does not deal specifically with Babylonia. And as a result, the language is back to the Hebrew language. So this is a vision now that Daniel had. And I saw in a vision, and it came to pass when I saw that I was at Shushan in the palace, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw a vision, and I was by the river Ulay. Now this Shushan was a province in Persia. But of course, at this time, Persia was still under the control of Babylonia, and it seemed to have been one of the capital cities. Daniel said he was in the palace at this place. It's in the province of Elam. And I saw in a vision and was by the river Ulay. Now, if we had a map, we could plot where this Ulay runs, but it's there in Persia, which would be north of the city of Babylonia. Then I lifted up mine eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram which had two horns, and the two horns, but one was higher, and the higher came. Now a ram, the bank of this river, and the ram has two. There's a shorter horn and a higher horn, and the higher horn came up last. Now we're going to find that this ram is representative of the kingdom of Media and Persia. We're already past now in this vision the time of the Babylonian Empire, but the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians are what are represented by this lamb. The short horn is the kingdom of Media, and the long horn, which came up last, but it was longer or larger, represents Persia. And so as we know, well documented from history, the Median king conquered Babylonia first, and then the Persian kingdom came in and took over that, and when Cyrus became king of Persia, then they went into their full-blown power, and so it was a horn to come up later, but it was a larger horn than the first horn. But really the two are together on this one animal because they are really considered to be one kingdom combined out of those two, the Medo-Persian Empire. Now this is the second beast that we had in the last chapter, and it's the second part of the image that Nebuchadnezzar saw in his dream. So the one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward, so that no beast might stand before him, neither was there any that could deliver out of his hands, but he did according to his will and became great. So this was a great empire, and it pushed in these directions that he names here. It did push westward and northward and southward. and no beast. You know, the other kingdoms were typified symbolized by beasts. No beast could stand before him. And he did according to his will. None could be delivered out of his hand. And he became great. Now, as we think of this Medo-Persian Empire being represented by a realm, I'd like to read what Mr. Clark says on that subject. By the realm, the empire of the Medes and the Persians was pointed out, as explained by the angel Gabriel in verse 20, and particularly Cyrus, who was the founder of that empire. And then he goes on here and shows that a ram was the symbol of the Persians, and a ram's head with two horns, one higher than the other, appears as such in different part of the ruins of this Persepolis. So they have ruins of this Persian Empire that depicts a picture of a ram with two horns, one horn being higher than the other, as an actual symbol that they had taken. So really it seems then that this ram being symbolic is more literal in some ways than we might like to give it credit for. Now in verse 5, and as I was considering, here he was seeing this ram and the two horns and how powerful he was and which directions he could conquer in. No other beast could stand before him. As he was considering this thing, verse 5, behold, an he-goat came from the west on the face of the whole earth and touched not the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Now this he-goat, we're going to see, is representative of the empire of Alexander the Great, or the Grecian Empire, or another name for it is the Macedonian Empire. So it's the Grecian Empire, and it's symbolized by the he-goat. Now let me read to you what he says about the he-goat as a symbol here. This was Alexander the Great, and a goat was a very proper symbol of the Grecian or Macedonian people. Bishop Newton very properly observes that 200 years before the time of Daniel, they were called Aegeida, that is, the goat's people. Now you remember, as we look on our map, there is a sea there which separates Macedonia from Asia Minor called the Aegean Sea. It's spelled A-E-G-E-A-N, Aegean Sea. Well, that means the goat sea. Well, these people were called the goat's people, and the origin of which name is said to be as follows. Carinus, their first king, going with a multitude of Greeks to seek a new habitation in Macedonia, was advised by an oracle to take the goats for his guides, and afterwards, seeing a herd of goats flying from a violent storm, he followed them to Edessa, and there he fixed the seat of his empire and made the goats his ensigns or standards and called the place Aegea, that is, the goat's town. And the people were called Aegeada, the goat's people, and names which are derived from this word, which means a goat, are as follows. The city Aegea, A-E-G-E, or A-E-G-E-A, was the usual burying place of the Macedonian kings. And in reference to this origin, Alexander called his son by Roxana Alexander Aegeus, which means Alexander the Goat. And all this shows the very great propriety of the symbol here being used for this kingdom to be represented then by the goat. And as I mentioned, we have on the map the Aegean Sea, which is spelled exactly the same way as these are. Alexander named his son the Goat. The place where they buried the king was the goat, and the people were called the goat's people. So this nation is represented here by a he-goat. And now we're going to see what this goat could do. He came from the west, which means, of course, that Macedonia was west of Persia. So he came from the west on the face of the whole earth, and touched not the ground. That is, he was He was able to travel so swiftly that it was as though he were flying. And you know, when he was represented by the other beast, he had four wings on his back. So here he's represented as though he could fly and not touch the ground. And Alexander conquered this area so rapidly that it was a very notable historical fact that he was able to conquer so much territory in such a short time. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. And we're going to find that this notable horn is actually going to be Alexander the Great. That's what the notable horn will represent between the eyes of this he-goat. And he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran unto him in the fury of his power. So now we have a conflict. This he-goat is running into this ram that stands by the river, and there's a great conflict there. Let me read Mr. Clark's comment on this verse. This and the following verse give an account of the overthrow of the Persian Empire by Alexander. And ran unto him in the fury of his power means that the conflicts between the Greeks and the Persians were excessively severe. Alexander first vanquished the generals of Darius at the river Granicus in Phrygia. He next attacked and totally routed Darius at the Strait of Issus in Cilicia, and afterwards at the plains of Arbelia in Assyria. One can hardly read these words, says Bishop Newton. The ram, which I had seen standing by the river, ran unto him in the fury of his power, without having the image of Darius's army standing and guarding the river Granicus, and of Alexander on the other side, with his forces plunging in, swimming across the stream, and rushing on the enemy with all the fire and fury that can be conceived. Now in verse 7, and I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was moved with choler against him, and this word choler means anger, moved with anger against him, and smote the ram, and brake his two horns, and there was no power in the ram to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground, and stamped upon him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. Now, break the two horns would be he broke both of the kings or the kingdoms. He totally vanquished this ram. He threw him to the ground. He stamped on him and just completely obliterated him so that he no longer really existed as a power or as a force at all. Now, in verse 7, Mr. Clark says, he subdued Persia and Media. He sacked and burnt the royal city of Persepolis, the capital of the Persian Empire, and even in its ruins, one of the wonders of the world to the present day. This he did because he was moved with choler against Darius, who had endeavored to draw off his captains with bribes and had labored to induce some of his friends to assassinate him. Alexander, finding this, would listen to no proposal of peace and was determined never to rest till he destroyed Darius and his whole empire. In Media, Darius was seized and made prisoner by some of his own treacherous subjects and afterward basely murdered. So there was no power to stand against him. That is, he was totally destroyed. These two horns were. There was no peace made. There was no conditions of surrender. He was obliterated. None could deliver the ram out of his hand. Verse 8. Therefore the he-goat waxed very great. So you can see how he was growing now as he conquered these other major portions of the world. As he conquered Syria, or the region that had been Syria, and Persia and Media and all the areas that had been Babylonia and Egypt, conquered all of these territories. He waxed very great. And when he was strong, the great horn was broken, for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. Now, Alexander the Great didn't live very long. He died at about the age of 30. So just whenever this great power was really getting to roll, and it seemed to be at the very zenith of its supremacy, Alexander died. So the great horn was broken. But four of his generals each took a province and began to rule and set up a separate rule in four provinces. So we have then that four notable ones came up in the place of this horn toward the four winds of heaven. There they were scattered. Egypt, Syria, and four places here. Mark says, the regal family dead, the governors of province usurped the title of kings, and Antigonus, one being slain at the Battle of Issus, they were reduced to four, as already seen. Then he names these four. One was Seleucus, who had Syria and Babylon, and from whom came the solicitor, famous in history, Lysimachus, who had Asia Minor, Ptolemy, the son of Lagus, who had Egypt, and from whom sprang the Lagidae, and Cassander, who had Greece and the neighboring countries. These held dominion toward the four winds of heaven. Cassander had the western parts, Lysimachus had the northern region, Ptolemy possessed the southern countries, and Seleucus had the eastern provinces. And verse 9, and out of one of them came forth a little horn, which waxed exceeding great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the pleasant land. Now, the question here is, what is the little horn then that came up out of these four that took the place of the big horn? Well, this little horn has to be the Roman Empire, which started small, but it grew and grew and grew until it became a very, very great power. It was the one that was depicted last time by the terrible beast. It's the one in the vision of the first king that was the legs of iron and the feet, you know, that were mixed with iron and clay. The Roman Empire. It began as the little horn and became very great. Now it waxed exceeding great toward the south and toward the east. Toward the south would mean that it conquered Egypt, which it did. Toward the east would mean that it conquered Syria, which it did. And it really rose primarily of the combination of the powers of Egypt and Syria. But then he says also that he waxed great toward the pleasant land. Now the pleasant land, that happens to be Judea. We have several phrases in the Bible that depict Judea as being this pleasant land. Even in Daniel, the 11th chapter of Daniel, we have a couple of references to the glorious land. And so that's Judea. And certainly, Judea did become a Roman province. It was governed and ruled by Roman dictators. It was an occupied country. And so this is what the prophecy is really getting down to now, is the fact that Judea was occupied by the Roman power. Now this was some several hundred years now before Christ. Verse 10, and it waxed great even to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and of the stars to the ground and stamped upon them. Now this verse here seems a little difficult to make an interpretation of. But it waxed great even to the host of heaven. The host of heaven, in all probability here, would have to be the higher up authorities in the Jewish nation, in the Jewish religion. The priests, the high priest, the scribes, maybe some of the kings even, would be included here in the host of heaven. Because, you know, God's people on this earth are considered to be a heavenly thing and in a heavenly place. Not heaven itself, but a place that's of heaven. The kingdom today is known as the kingdom of heaven. It's not heaven, but the kingdom of heaven. So the heavenly host would be those who occupy the position in God's kingdom or in God's house on this earth. So it became great even to the host of heaven. That is, it overcame or overpowered or exerted influence or authority over them. And it cast down some of the host and of the stars to the ground and stamped upon them. Now, the heavenly bodies are many times used to represent in prophecy, to represent notable persons. So as these hosts of heaven, that is, as these scribes and these Pharisees and these priests and the high priest and the Levites and all of the people involved there, as they then were cast down and subverted, even the Jewish Sanhedrin, you know, to this Roman power, then this is looked upon as the host being cast down and the stars of heaven being cast down, and he stamped upon them. I'd like to refer here to an interesting passage of Scripture that to me seems to shed some light on this. Matthew 24, verse 29. Not only does this shed some light on this, but Daniel then also shed some light on this Scripture in Matthew 24. In Matthew 24, Jesus is talking about the time and when the city of Jerusalem is going to be destroyed and the temple is going to be destroyed, and also the time whenever the world is coming to an end. Well, in talking about this destruction of the temple, in Matthew 24, back here in verse 15, when ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, and we haven't gotten to that verse, that's going to be in a later chapter, stand in the holy place, whoso readeth, let him understand. Then let them which be in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him which is on the housetop not come down and take anything out of his house. Neither let him which is in the field return back to take his clothes. And woe unto them that are with child, and to them that give suck in those days. And pray that your flight be not in the winter, neither on the Sabbath day. For then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor shall ever be. And except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. He's describing the destruction of Jerusalem, which occurred in A.D. 70. And those Christians who lived in the city of Jerusalem, they were, whenever they saw the sign of this destruction of the city, whenever it was surrounded by Titus's army, the abomination of desolation as spoken of in Daniel, they were then to flee to the mountains. They were to get out of this city because the city was in for a siege and they were no doubt going to be killed. They were to get out of the city. They were to pray that their flight be not on the Sabbath day because other Jews wouldn't let them travel on the Sabbath day. They were to woe unto them that give suck with child. It would be a bad time for, and pray that your flight be not in the winter. So this is what they were told to do. And we have now the prophecy about the destruction of Jerusalem given by Christ. But the verse I want to get to is verse 29. He says, immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heaven shall be shaken. Now we so often read this verse and want to interpret it as a literal falling of the sun and the moon and the stars, a literal shaking of the heavenly bodies, but it just might be what Daniel has reference to over here in our 10th verse. And it waxed great even to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the hosts and of the stars to the ground and stamped upon them. This is the Roman Empire as it is overrunning and as it is completely obliterating the temple and subduing the city of Jerusalem and killing those people by the hundreds of thousands. And certainly the higher up in the Jewish religion were not only killed but scattered to the four corners of the earth. This could be what Daniel 24:29 is saying when he says the stars and the moon were darkened and they fell and they were shaken. So instead of us trying to interpret him as literal stars and moon and sun, it may be the higher-ups in the Jewish religion that were then finally brought to a state in which they no longer even existed as such. Because from that day to this, there's been no temple service. There's been no Levitical priesthood as they knew it then. The Jews do not worship as they did then. The temple doesn't exist. So I just mention that in passing as a very interesting commentary, quite possibly a commentary by Jesus, given on this 10th verse. And yet the 10th verse helps us to understand Matthew 24:29. Yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host. Now, this host of heaven, if it were the higher authorities in the Jewish religion, then the prince of the host would be God himself. So this Roman Empire magnified himself. That is, this little horn that became so great. It magnified himself even to the prince of the host, that is, to God himself. And by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. That's the temple. There was no more need for the daily sacrifice. There was no more need for the place of the sanctuary. You know, that veil had been rent in the temple when Christ was crucified. But it was by him, that is, by the power of this little horn, that this daily sacrifice was finally taken away. This continual sacrifice made every day, he's the one that put a stop to that. And it was by him that the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Here's a prophecy now given some 400 to 500 years before it happened, describing exactly how it would happen. Daniel didn't understand it. Nobody at that particular time understood it. They hadn't even got back to Jerusalem the first time, from the first captivity. And yet he's still talking about the next destruction of it. I was reading some in Josephus today about this destruction of the temple. And Josephus just has volumes and volumes on it. He has book 2 and book 3 and book 4, I believe, or book 6 in his Wars of the Jews, and then several in the Antiquities of the Jews. But he was telling about the Roman army as they went into this temple, how that they desecrated the temple. They took out the vessels and all of the temple, and they hung up the Roman standards all on the wall in the temple. And these Roman standards were things that they actually worshipped. It's kind of like people today giving, you know, salute to the flag, and except they were really a lot more devoted to these symbols than people would be today. But they hung them up in the temple and kind of made it a headquarters for the army. And so it was desecrated. The sanctuary was no longer the sanctuary. And this power is the one that put an end to it. This power is the one that stopped it, really, in so far as man's eyes goes. God stopped it back at the cross. But this power stopped it as far as man's eyes goes. And I say God stopped it back at the cross. There's a little bit of a gray area there that we're not able to really comment on, because even Paul, you know, went to the temple and he paid the price of some who were being purified in the temple years later before his destruction. And an host, now if you think verse 11 is difficult, verse 12 is even harder. And a host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression, and it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and prospered. So a host being him, this either means that a large people were given him, or it means power were given him. Some 1,100,000 people taken into captivity. And some 90,000 people were killed on this occasion, according to Josephus. You know, we're talking about over 1 million people in one city here. And really a terrible thing. Matthew 24, he said, except those days be shortened, there'd be no flesh saved. But for the elect's sake, that is the members of the church who were in this vicinity, he shortened the days of it. And but the members of the church, you know, were already forewarned. Get out of the city. Flee. Go to the mountains. If you're on the housetop, don't go back. If you're out in the field, don't go back. Don't go back in your house, take anything out. Leave when the time comes. So a host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression. Now, I think what this really is saying here is because of the transgression of the Jews, they had stumbled at the Savior. They had stumbled.